I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. China and the United States are both choosing leaders this month. President Obama was reelected last week, and the Communist Party Congress is scheduled to choose the current vice president, Xi Jinping, to run China for the next decade. Outgoing President Hu Jintao addressed the Congress last week, touting his accomplishments while warning that rampant corruption was a threat to the Communist Party. A number of party leaders have been implicated in a series of scandals. We asked Jacques Delisle to join us. He just got back from a trip to China. He's the Stephen A. Kozin Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, also Deputy Director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China, and he's the Director of the Asia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is located here in Philadelphia. And Jacques Delisle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
How would you describe the relationship between the United States and China?
Very complicated, and by now the world's most important bilateral relationship. I was in a debate with somebody who's written a book on the subject, and I thought the best way to describe our relationship was congaging our frenemies, which is we've got a mixture of containment and engagement. And we view China as partly a friend and partly an enemy. It's a deeply complex and ambivalent relationship. The good news is it's now a very dense relationship. So I think the odds of it coming completely off the rails are quite low, but there are areas of genuine conflict of interest and areas of significant mutual mistrust and suspicion.
What do you mean by dense?
Well, it's now multifaceted. We've got an immensely very, very large trade relationship, which is a good thing in terms of giving both sides an economic stake and the other's well-being and progress. On the other hand, it causes frictions. So we have the trade deficit issues. We have the charges of currency manipulation that go along with that. We have a dense investment relationship as well. The U.S. is a major source of foreign investment in China, and China has been under some pressure from the U.S. to become more liberal in allowing investment in. They opened up a great deal over the last generation, but there's still some friction points, particularly for inflows of pure capital and investment in the stock markets and such. And China's now become an outbound investor, which has raised all the issues that have caused some frictions. You remember this Sinoc-Unocal deal a couple of years ago, the recent issues from Congress about possible spy chips being put in electronics. So when you've got that kind of dense economic relationship, it's in some ways very good, but it also creates its stumbling blocks.
China, though, also holds a lot of American debt.
Yes,
does that mean we are indebted to China?
Well, in the sense that China owns a lot of U.S. debt, yes. What that means is a good deal more complicated. I mean, the old joke is when you owe your banker a little money, you have a problem. When you owe your banker a lot of money, he has a problem. And China's very much in that position. So China is aware of the fact that holding a lot of U.S. debt has some problems. They've tried to diversify out of it, but there are not very many better places to put your money. There is something of what would be called a mercantilist approach to trade in China. The idea is you pile up lots of foreign exchange. That's a good thing. And China's done that. It's invested that in U.S. assets, U.S. Productive assets as well as debt. And there's always a concern that might be used to political ends. But I think there's a sense that if it's used too much to political ends, it becomes sort of mutual assured destruction.
You were in China recently, and while the American election was going on, were Chinese people and some of the leaders, perhaps students, were they following the American election?
Very much so. I should say I voted absentee ballot before I left. But yes, they were very much interested in the American election, in some ways much more interested in that than in their own party Congress, where the results are a good deal less suspenseful. I mean, I think Nate Silver would have a hard time making a name for himself in China, so it's pretty well known who's going to come out in the top couple of positions.
And kind of opaque in terms of just how this process takes place.
It is opaque. I mean, although it's sort of odd, we know who the top two leaders are going to be. We don't know the full lineup of the rest of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, which is the body of probably this time seven that collectively lead the country. But we've seen Xi Jinping, who's coming in as Party General Secretary and who in March will become State President, and Li Keqiang, who will become Premier. That's been set for quite some time now, and we've known who the broader group of top elite will be drawn from, but we know relatively little about who exactly they are. We have biographical information, we have hunches and some information about their preferences in terms of policy, but it's not 100% predictive. You rise in that system by being anointed from above, by marching up the ranks, keeping your nose clean to some degree. So any bold initiatives are very unlikely to be revealed beforehand. I mean, there's some hints and some rumors kicking around, but it's very little that's going to be all that reliable. And even if we were to know their preferences, implementing them is not always easy in a system which has a degree of collective leadership and some significant vested interests.
What does it tell us, though, that there was so much security about around the meeting of this Congress in Beijing? My understanding on Tiananmen Square, rather close to Tiananmen Square. But when you read about some of the security, it almost doesn't make any sense. For instance, pigeons were not allowed to be flown.
Yeah, it gets a little comical even. Taxi drivers were told to put on the locks and take the window cranks off so people couldn't open the windows as they got too close.
The idea of opening the windows and shouting something,
throwing some pamphlets, who knows. And there are obviously protests. We have Tibetan independence folks or Tibetan autonomy people who've taken extreme actions, including self-immolation. And you have a lot of people who are trying to protest on the web, and a lot of the negative comments were blocked and so on. I mean, the level of security that surrounds significant anniversary dates like the anniversary of June 4th, or that surrounds major party plenum, major party meetings like this, is always quite high. I don't think it's a sense there's going to be any riot or anything that actually topples the government, but you don't want incidents that are embarrassing and awkward. And I think this is a particularly tough and sensitive party Congress. I mean, the only reason it was held so close to the U.S. election was that it had to be pushed back several weeks. It ordinarily would have been held in October, probably early October. But because of some of the scandals that rocked the top elite earlier this year, it had to be put off until they could figure out how to deal with something that was threatening to cause quite a schism and that required a rejiggering of the factional balances that are always part of the process of putting together a new top leadership slate.
And there have been a number of scandals. Would you say the scandal involving Bo Lijai, or I'm mispronouncing the name?
Bo Xilai.
Mm-hmm. Is that the number one scandal in China?
It's the number one scandal in many years in China. I think it's probably the biggest a crisis and shakeup in the leadership since Tiananmen. Now, it's not on the level of Tiananmen in 1989, but it's been relatively smooth sailing since then, and this is the first major tumult and fall in such a prominent and public way of a top leader that we've seen in the 20 years since.
Accused of corruption, a murder cover-up? This is damning stuff.
It's got everything. I mean, somebody needs to get the movie rights to this. I mean, it really is extraordinary. The thing about Bo Xilai, I mean, the immediate scandal is tied up with the murder of a British businessman who had extensive dealings with Bo's wife, Gu Kailai. And he was, on the account that we have, poisoned by her with some help from Wang Lijun, who was Bo Xilai's police chief. But it really comes against a broader background of what Bo Xilai was up to down in Chongqing, the large inland metropolis industrial city that he was the party secretary for. He'd previously been up in Dalian, a city up in the northeast of China, which was one of the open coastal cities and had been sort of a darling project of reform. He went through a couple of other incarnations, including as Minister of Commerce, and then wound up as party secretary down in Chongqing. And what became so controversial there was really two things. One was the Chongqing model, as it's sometimes called, which is very much at odds with what reformers want to see in China. So it was very much a state industry-dominated economic model, and there's a controversy about whether the great growth rates there were achieved by simple diversion of state funds or through an effective state-led model. There was a view of a return to singing red, going back to old Mao songs, a very sort of old-style socialist.
You mean that literally?
Quite literally, singing red. They dusted off Cultural Revolution-style rhetoric, and he cast himself very much as what we would call almost a right-wing, although in Chinese terms, left-wing populist leader, looking out for those who were left behind by reforms, taking care of the poor, and was that whole package, which is in some ways a bit of the populism that we saw from the outgoing leadership, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, the people who are about to step down. But it also had this kind of neo-socialist or old-style flavor to it. So the substantive ideas of the so-called Chongqing model created some tensions. But the other thing was he used it as a base to try to elbow his way into the top leadership. And what he did, in effect, was to campaign rather openly. And he went outside those nice, managed, opaque channels we were talking about to kind of bid for a position on the Politburo Standing Committee. And that was not something you do. That's breaking the rules of the game. And then the scandal broke about the murder and other things when his police chief, Wang Lijun, went to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu and dumped the story. Now, it had been percolating before that, but once that was out, of course, the jig was up. But also what was going on is he was running a pretty nasty, repressive, even murderous regime down in Chongqing, squeezing entrepreneurs. Many of them were trying to flee. And he, at one point, persecuted a lawyer who was doing nothing more than defending a client in a case that was part of the crackdown on the so-called mafia. Sophia and Chongqing. So it's this really complicated, messy, and really quite brutal regime that he was running down in Chongqing.
And where is Bo Xilai today? And what is the party, the Politburo, what are they going to do about him?
Well, he's in custody and has been since this whole scandal broke back in the spring. His wife has already been prosecuted and convicted for murder and sentenced to a suspended death sentence, so technically death, but it won't be imposed. Wang Lijun, the police chief, has faced a quite lengthy sentence as well. And Bo Xilai will be prosecuted. He's been removed from his posts, and one of the things that was done at the beginning of this sort of cluster of final meeting of the last party central committee into the party congress this time was to strip him of his posts formally. He had already been relieved of his party position down in Chongqing, and now he's going to face prosecution. And we don't know exactly what the charges are going to be, but the story is it's going to be about bribery, corruption, and about abuse of power, with the main focus of the abuse of power charges likely to be the cover-up of the murder, or the attempt to cover up the murder.
I was also reading about the railway minister, and I won't butcher his name on the air, but accused or maybe even found guilty of $150 million of kickbacks, having something like 18 mistresses. I don't know if that's sequentially or altogether?
I don't know, but it looks a little bit like the Qing Dynasty at its worst. Liu Jiujun was the railway minister, the highest-ranking official to be convicted of corruption. Mm. And there was another scandal involving a guy named Ling Jihua. He was sort of Hu Jintao's fixer, as I think he's often referred to, a political ally of the outgoing president and party general secretary, whose son wrapped his Ferrari around a highway support post, semi-clothed with a couple of women in a similar state. I mean, it's this kind of stuff that is causing a bit of a legitimacy problem for the regime. Many other things are too, but these are just the most salacious bits.
But if we're talking, there's more, but is China then a communist country?
Well, it's ruled by the Chinese Communist Party. That's certainly true.
But when you think of the ideals of communism, this doesn't sound like those ideals.
No, certainly is nothing you would find in Marx's utopia. That's absolutely the case. And indeed, in particular, much of what this is bound up with is the extreme wealth that has been accumulated by those who are at the top politically and their relatives. And that is often seen as a product of corruption, and rightly so, but there's also this kind of flaunting of it. And I think in some ways the biggest threat to a regime which for the last 30-plus years has based its legitimacy on the ability to deliver the goods, to make people better off, it's facing a problem when people think that those who are getting fabulously wealthy now are not getting there by skill or by hard work or even by luck, but by connections. You know, that's a problem. And as the political report from Hu Jintao recognizes, and as everybody in China, from hardcore reformers to defenders of the system, recognize, the sense of unfairness and the sense of social and economic inequality is something that is a real problem and it needs to be dealt with. Now, the outgoing group, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, made some moves in that direction. They're often called populist because of that, but they've achieved remarkably little if you look at the numbers in terms of income distribution.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about China, and our guest is Jacques Delisle. He's the Stephen A. Kozin Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, also Deputy Director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China and Director of the Asia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Just got back from China this past weekend, and we are picking his brain to help us understand this important country, the U.S. relationship with this country, and what is going on inside of China. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Holy Family University supports WHYY and is offering an information session for educators interested in principal certification on Thursday, November 15th. Holy Family's principal certification can be completed in 23 credits or 32 credits with a master's degree and focuses on developing effective and ethical school leaders. The program begins at 5 p.m. in the Education and Technology Center at the Northeast Philadelphia campus. More information via email. Email address is gradstudy@holyfamily.edu.
For almost half a century, rock innovator and Velvet Underground co-founder John Cale has braved a hostile music industry to pursue his art rock vision.
The business is not set up for reinvention. Something that aggravates you and you don't understand is not really the simplest thing to sell, which is really the business.
We talk art and commerce with John Cale this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This Thanksgiving weekend, a concert for family and friends at the Kimmel Center as the Philadelphia Orchestra presents Parisian Impressions. Stefan Deneuve leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in George Gershwin's An American in Paris and Debussy's Image. Thanksgiving tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. November 23rd, 24th, and 25th, Thanksgiving weekend at the Kimmel Center, A Taste of Paris, Gershwin, and more with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking about China with our guest Jacques Delisle, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Interestingly, the New York Times did a rather detailed story about the now outgoing Prime Minister of China and the fact that his extended family has gotten fabulously wealthy over, I don't know, the last 10 or 20 years.
The Times story was a big deal. It got the New York Times website blocked in China. It's still blocked and will be till at least the end of the Party Congress. One of the more amusing conversations I had during this last trip to China was with some former students who are now in their 30s. And their take on this was either the Times didn't do a very good job at catching what assets were out there, or Wen Jiabao was pretty bad at being corrupt. I mean, the cynicism about corruption is so high that $3 billion, $2.7 billion dollars was seen as a relatively modest estimate.
Chump change.
Yeah. When you're talking skimming even a very small percentage of the world's second largest economy, and an economy that's been growing at 10% per year for the last couple of decades, actually several decades, that's pretty impressive. So there's a lot of skim to be taken off it, and it is a very much a state intervened in market. A lot of opportunities are still things where the state functions as a gatekeeper, and the state's deeply involved in some very large and profitable enterprises. So there are lots of opportunities for the well-connected to trade on their connections.
But do you think this is corruption, and that what they are doing is illegal even by China's standards?
Some of it certainly is. Some of it is much grayer, right? I mean, you've got a lot of people who are getting fabulously wealthy in China, not just those who are connected. When people are setting up businesses that have a high potential for profit, it's a nice little insurance policy and maybe a marginal benefit to get somebody who can help. And some of these involve government contracts, which always have this question arising around them. But there certainly is a lot of just good old-fashioned corruption that's clearly illegal by Chinese standards as well, and that's why you've seen a lot of pressure toward disclosure of assets. Officially, party officials, people in the party who hold state offices as well, have to disclose their assets and their immediate family members' assets, but not the extended family often. And there's a lot of non-disclosure, obviously. Certainly the things that are flat-out bribes are not going to get out. But it's a lot of money, and there's a huge amount of suspicion. Again, deep cynicism about corruption among top officials and their family, but also deep cynicism in China about why the New York Times ran this story just right now and where the Times got the information. So there's a belief that almost everything has a political story behind it, which is indeed part of the problem.
Well, it seems to me there's nothing unusual about rising wealth and the temptation of if not corruption, certainly amassing wealth for oneself.
Yeah,
I mean this it's not just unique to China.
No, by no means. The thing that makes it complicated in the Chinese context is that you do have this hybrid of an economy that has become very marketized and very open to the outside world, but still has these large state and party-linked entities within it, and where access to opportunities, often highly profitable opportunities, do you get to go into this sector, do you get to list, do you get bank loans, can turn fairly heavily on connections.
Tell us what we know about Xi.
What do we know about Xi Jinping? Well, we know a lot about the biography. He is one of the so-called princelings. That is, he is the son of someone who was a prominent leader in the revolutionary generation, Xi Zhongxun in his case. But then so was Bo Xilai. Bo Xilai is the son of Bo Yibo. So this notion that there is a coherent group of princelings that all are on the same page is just silly. I mean, not only were they, in a sense, rivals, although Bo was never going to pass Xi, but certainly somebody Xi did not want to see promoted into the top ranks. But they had very different substantive agendas. We know what Bo's was. Xi's, the suspicion is relatively reform-oriented. This is based on a bunch of things. Partly he is connected to this princeling group, which, in addition to their pedigree, have, partly because of their status, served largely in the rich coastal provinces. So he served in Zhejiang, which is a very wealthy area near Shanghai, in Shanghai itself, in Fujian, and so which is the area across the strait from Taiwan. So there's a sense that he has a deep understanding and commitment to this kind of economic openness, this market orientation, and this somewhat lessened concern with inequality and such. So there's that sort of biographical piece to it. He's been vice president for a while, which has given him occasion to opine on various issues. Those have been relatively pro-reform. He and his group are thought to be relatively closely associated with Jiang Zemin, the prior president and party general secretary, Hu Jintao's predecessor. And that was a group that was much more associated with his Gold Coast go-go economic strategy and less concerned with rebalancing and social equality and so on. So there's that package of views that suggests he would lean that way. And as we look toward the formation of the Politburo Standing Committee, the belief is that Jiang Zemin-affiliated people are going to do very well, and Hu Jintao-affiliated people are going to do less well. So that all points in a reformist direction. There is also the things in Hu Jintao's final party speech, the one he just gave at the Congress, which is a carefully negotiated document. And there are little tidbits in there that follow on what we've heard from Xi and others that looks more toward some political reform, a second wave of economic reform. So all the signals are there. That said, however, it's tough. The top leader doesn't get to call the shots the way he used to. It's a collective leadership to a significant degree. There are huge vested interests, including some of those very wealthy, elite-connected people we've talked about economically, talked about before in terms of corruption. So even with a certain agenda, it's going to be hard to push through. And I think everybody now realizes that the challenges immediately ahead include not only sustaining growth, but dealing with some of these questions of inequality and pollution and social unrest. And so you don't have a whole lot of policy options.
And when it comes to actually running China, it's a group of people, yes? The Politburo?
The Politburo Standing Committee, which is going to be seven this time, we believe, is certainly the group that is most important. Xi is clearly most important among them. He's first among not quite equals. And in a sense of steering the course of the country, that's true. But again, it's become deeply complex. There are vested interests of various sorts, social interests, ministerial and bureaucratic interests, regional interests. And one needs to take account of all these things. The army is another interest. I mean, it's a very much more complex and pluralistic system than it used to be.
Thinking about the millions, or perhaps hundreds of millions of people who are now middle class in China, what are their aspirations and how do they view their government?
They have, I think, a complicated view toward their government. They obviously are a group that has emerged entirely under the reforms, and especially since the early 90s and sort of second wave of reform. So in some sense, they've done very well under the existing system. But there comes a point when you've got education, you've got assets, you want some rights and some stability, some belief that your interests are going to be protected. You tend to develop a certain degree of efficacy, a sense that you should be able to have some influence on the rules that govern your lives. And that kind of thing is very much part of it. On the other hand, how radical do they go? Complicated picture. I mean, we've seen middle-class protests on things like environmentally polluting plants that they've managed to shut down by opposing. They've proposed maglev trains in their backyards, all these kind of very core bread and butter and life quality issues. They've started to voice a great deal of concern about things like environmental pollution and food safety and that sort of thing. Are they pushing for radical democracy? Some are, some aren't, but a lot are not because they are still a minority and they've done pretty well under the existing system. So I think it's a complicated balance. The other thing they've gained that wasn't true before is they have access to outside information.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I would think once you're middle class and you have access to outside information, you want it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you start to think, why isn't China like that? We've achieved this level of well-being. Why don't we get some of the other trappings that go with being middle class elsewhere in the world? And they get this information over the web. I mean, the Times isn't always blocked. And most people who care, who are genuine urban middle class professional types, they have proxy servers and ways of getting around it. Weibo, the Chinese Twitter, is huge. These people travel abroad. They're sometimes educated abroad. So there's lots of information going around. The degree of information control has plummeted in the last generation.
You have taught there, so obviously you have had a chance to get to know some of the students there. Their aspirations?
I think, in many ways there's still a material component to it. Right. And people are very concerned about income, and one of the major sources of anxiety among the educated urbanites is things like housing costs. And paying for raising kids, which indeed among educated urbanites has made population control policy less significant than how do you buy an apartment and pay for the educational advantages and things of that ilk. But I think also there's more and more of a sense that they want some say in the way they are ruled and governed. They also want to be kept safe in a way that sometimes the government hasn't kept them safe. And so one of the biggest problems here are things like, you know, crime rate's not a problem, but things like unsafe food, terrible pollution, traffic unsafety, you know, the high-speed rail that derails, all these kinds of things. And there's also, I think, growing economic insecurity, the sense that the boom times are going to roll forever has really come down as people have started to face, even with high educations, they face difficulties finding employment. Or just a sense that it's not ever upward.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jacques Delisle, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about China. Again, he just got back from a trip to China, and he is the Stephen A. Kozin Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, Deputy Director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China, also Director of the Asia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Any questions or comments? And the U.S.'s relationship with China is extremely important. That is an extreme understatement there. 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Nancy from Lafayette Hill to join us. And Nancy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Delisle, speak to us about the rule of law in China that Americans and the other part of the Western world, you know, want them to think about law the way we do, as we understand it. But since law has never been part of their history, and you as the law professor and I presume advisor to that government, how do you see the rule of law or the idea of law actually coming into that that country that's so based on relationships?
Nancy, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Subject near and dear to my heart. it's been a long, slow struggle. I mean, there actually is a very long-standing Chinese legal tradition. It goes back, you know, thousands of years, quite literally. But the idea of a Western-style rule of law, or one that borrows some from Western models, is relatively new. It's something that didn't really get going again until the beginning of the Reform era, and it reacted to the utter lawlessness of the Cultural Revolution decade in the late years of Mao. It's a very complicated phenomenon, and we've seen huge progress in many areas. You've seen a vast expansion of legal education, a vast professionalization of the ranks of lawyers and judges. You see a huge number of cases that are just ordinary cases, ordinary economic cases, or even some administrative law cases against the government that are handled in a perfectly standard way. And there's a belief that you need this to keep the market economy rolling. And we've seen just really quite impressive progress on that, and a much more sophisticated set of laws and rules, sometimes honored in the breach, but by no means always honored in the breach, that are what you'd expect to find in a market economy. And there have been repeated revisions to deal with this. There's been even a new tort law that tries to deal with some of those social safety threats that I've been mentioning through private as well as the more traditional regulatory means. But there are still many, many problems. There is huge corruption in the judiciary. There is political intervention in politically charged cases. I mean, certainly prosecutions of political dissidents in the criminal system are still commonplace. And then the use of an informal sanction that doesn't require judicial process but can entail incarceration for up to 3 years is still used in those areas. And there are cases where if you go up against a highly connected state-linked enterprise, particularly in its hometown, if it's a small town, your chances of success are not all that high, and your chances of a fair process are not all that high. So that's been quite complicated. What's sort of looking at it more from the top down, it's been a very pessimistic half a decade or more. There was a head of the Supreme People's Court, a guy named Xiaoyang, who was very much associated with the notion of judicial independence, a professionalized judiciary, of a shift toward more formal adjudication as a means of dealing with social conflicts and government misbehavior. And he was replaced by a guy named Wang Shengjun, who is now still the Supreme People's Court head, who is much more associated with an emphasis on mediation and informal dispute resolution, a lot of pressure against this kind of formal legality, and his doctrine of the so-called three supremes, which is you should look not just to law, but also to party policy and so-called public opinion. That's been a real step back. We're waiting to see what happens next. One of the names that's rumored as a possible near-term replacement would be much closer, we expect, to the prior model, which would be a nice step forward. But it's been a bad several years.
And Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you advise the Chinese government on law issues?
I work with a variety of programs that that have provided legal advice over the years. I have not worked directly for the Chinese government, but for international funded programs and with some of the Chinese who are involved in the process of reforming laws in the judicial system.
You had mentioned earlier the fact that there have been a number of many people concerned about the level of pollution in China. One of the phrases that I ran across was rich and poisoning itself. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, one of the things that's been sort of kicking up increasingly in the social media is this saying, look, we're plenty rich. We have all these things that rich people have. This is obviously from the middle classes in the cities. It doesn't refer to the very, very poor people still in many parts of the countryside and some of the poor in the cities. But the people who get on Twitter, the Chinese Twitter,
yes.
And they say, "Why? You know, we're rich. Why can't we have the other things that developed countries have, like clean air and safe water?" And if you look around the so-called incidents, and China reports, well, they no longer report. For a long time, China would report the number of mass incidents per year. We weren't quite sure how
that
would.
And what does that mean, incidents?
We don't really know. There's never been an official definition. But the sense is it's some kind of public protest, perhaps one that requires some kind of state response. I mean, not riot squads, but you know, they're enough to be taken seriously. And they were climbing at the rate of about 10,000 a year. And when they hit about 100,000 several years ago, they just plain old stop reporting. And there are groups that try to estimate where these numbers are, and the sense is they're still going up. The two largest causes or occasions for these kinds of protests are environmental pollution and land takings.
And how severe is the environmental pollution?
It's bad. I mean, yeah, there have been some efforts to deal with it, and green GDP is now something that that officials are supposedly measured by and not just pure GDP. But the pollution is just awful. I mean, you get, you know, statistics vary, but China's got more than 50% market share in the world's most polluted cities. You know, the number of rivers that are severely polluted is quite high, and it's, you know, it's really not a good situation.
And you mentioned land taking. Is that the government taking land for perhaps an infrastructure project, something like that, a road, a railroad?
It's a mixture of things, but there's always a state involvement. There are really kind of two major types, as it were, of land rights taking. I mean, in China, you can't own land. The urban land is owned by the state, and the rural land is owned by the collectivity, which is essentially the local state. But long-term use rights can be sold and can be transferred. And so what's happened in the countryside, particularly the parts of the countryside near the cities, is that land has to be converted from rural use to urban use to make it usable for the kinds of things we think of as cities, you know, housing and factories and such. So there's a huge surplus to be reaped when you reclassify the land. So we have a problem of coerced takings from peasants to sell to developers, with the local government being involved in the process, and that value increase being captured. Now, there are rules requiring compensation, mm-hmm. and the outgoing Premier Wen Jiabao has been very firm on saying they should be compensated, but the compensation in principle tends to be relatively low compared to value. And often what is to be paid in principle isn't in fact paid out. It sticks to the fingers of various officials. The other type of land rights taking is urban. That's mostly redevelopment, knocking over older, lower value uses for higher value uses. Here, too, compensation is supposed to be paid. It's often not adequate, and there's obviously huge social disruption in both these contexts. In fact, I was just this last week out at a place called Jiuxianqiao, which is the biggest urban demolition and reconstruction project all at once ever in China, at least under the current regime. And so there's 5,000 people who are going to have their area leveled and displaced. It became hugely controversial. They did a little local referendum on whether you wanted to allow the development to occur, and most people voted yes. There are questions about how accurate that was. But it's a big issue.
And how big is this development? What does it include? We're almost having a break here, but go ahead.
Well, it's a home to about 5,000 people. It's out in the northeast part of Beijing, sort of toward the airport for people who know the city. And it will be, you know, turned into some combination. I don't know what the plans are, but it will be some combination of office buildings and nicer residences. The people who live there will be moved out, will be given opportunities to buy apartments elsewhere. Whether they'll have the assets from this payment to do it or not is an open question, given housing prices in Beijing. And it is disruptive to that community, and a lot of people don't want to move. Some are willing to, some aren't.
And that's Jacques Delisle, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about China, something he knows something about. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We do want to talk about China's relationship with its neighbors, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. For nearly 75 years, Independence Blue Cross has been dedicated to improving the health and wellness of the people in southeastern Pennsylvania. Through the Independence Blue Cross Foundation and its new Healthy Futures Initiative, they are committed to transforming childhood wellness in our region. By encouraging children to eat right, get fit, and stay well through the new Healthy Futures Initiative, the Independence Blue Cross Foundation is changing the game. More information at ibxfoundation.org.
Mary Monica Mitchell writes popular etiquette columns, but her new book is very personal. It's a clever series of emails with the late Philadelphia communications professional Nessa Foreman, who died of cancer last year, a woman Mitchell calls her sister by choice. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Mitchell talks about her intimate exchange about love, etiquette, vulnerability, and ultimately saying goodbye. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring the American Repertory Ballet's production of The Nutcracker, now in its 49th season. Featuring Tchaikovsky's score, new set designs, and a cast of over 100. November 23rd through December 23rd at venues across New Jersey, including the Carter Theater in Princeton, Patriots Theater in Trenton, and the State Theater in New Brunswick. A full schedule at arballet.org. The American Repertory Ballet, and more online at JerseyArts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Communist Party's 18th Congress is being held in Beijing, China, under tight security. China's President Hu Jintao is stepping down this week after a decade in power, and the Vice President Xi Jinping is expected to assume leadership control. We're looking at the relationship between the U.S. and China and talking about China's growing economy, growing social unrest in parts of the country, problems of corruption, and the possibilities of reform. And again, our guest is Jacques Delisle, just got back from China this weekend, professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Asia program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Let me get to, looks like Crystal from South Philadelphia to join us. And Crystal, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Professor. My name is Crystal. Would you please comment on one serious issue, human rights abuse in China, in particular the persecution of Falun Gong, which is a spiritual meditation practice? And the persecution has begun in 1999, and it's lawless, has no legal base, and the Chinese government set up special agency called the 610 Office to persecute the Falun Gong practitioners. Would you please comment
sure.
on that?
Thank you, Crystal, for the call to Radio Times. Jacques, go ahead.
Well, Falun Gong, as you say, has been a target of repression since 1999. Some of the troubles actually started before that. It's one of the many things where if you look at it from the outside, sort of why is something that seems relatively unlikely to cause any significant trouble for the government, why does it receive such a harsh reaction? I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that what really started the persecution of Falun Gong was when they managed to have 10,000 people turn up unannounced on the doorstep of Zhongnanhai and the leadership compound where the top elite live and work without the security apparatus being aware of it. And that's a very scary thing. And it's the same type of concern about loss of control and the unexpected happening that leads to these anti-pigeon, anti-door handles or window cranks in the taxi thing. It's just not something that they want to see happen. Also, to some degree, the strongest reactions you get are, I think, against groups that seem to address what many people would describe as a spiritual vacuum in China. Mm-hmm. You're asking earlier if China is still communist. I say it's ruled by the Communist Party, but the genuine belief in communist ideology in any recognizable form or socialist ideology has plummeted. And so people cast about for other things. And it can be anything from the significant rise of Christian religion to something like Falun Gong to Neo-Confucians to just, you know, pure cynicism and money pursuits. These are all seen in some sense, and I think they probably are, as a lack of a set of values. And so what you hear a lot of talk about now from very conservative types to even quite liberal reformers is that China needs to solve its values problem. The glue that holds society together has come unstuck. Now, people have very different views about what way to go. But something like Falun Gong, which frankly a lot of Chinese regard as a little crazy, they do see it as a cult, even though, you know, there are certainly people who see it as just a completely innocuous meditation device, a way of finding meaning for people who are often not doing so well in the current economy and society. I asked the legal basis of it. You know, China's claimed legal bases for it. There's an anti-cult law. There are things like that. But there's certainly a lot of stuff that is informal at best, including the 610 offices, which have been the subject of some lawsuits in the U.S. even.
Let me ask you about a number of Tibetans who have set themselves on fire to protest Chinese rule, I guess to coincide with this meeting going on in Beijing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Tibetan and Uyghur Muslim, you know, northwest China, Xinjiang area, separatism is another big concern. Partly it has some of these same overtones, right? It's ethno-religious, and so it's a question of people who have a spiritual belief that gives them some fortitude. I think that's the other thing that's scary to the regime about things like Falun Gong and Tibetan Buddhists. I mean, people who self-immolate, and this happened with some Falun Gong people too, show a degree of dedication and zeal for their cause that cannot be cowed the way the threat of a job loss to someone who's more secular and materialistic, perhaps, would be. But you add in the Tibetan Xinjiang context, there are elements in those groups, by no means all, but there are elements who are genuinely separatist, and that pushes the other hot-button issue, which is national sovereignty and territorial integrity, which is part of what's going on in the East and South China Sea issues now.
Well, let me pick up on that, because President Obama is going to visit Myanmar, Burma, as it is called by some, and some other countries in Southeast Asia, not going to China. Do you think that is sending a message to China?
No, the U.S.-China symmetry is pretty well established. It goes on its own scheduled cycle, and Obama went to China in 2009. Hu Jintao, you know, visited here. Xi Jinping has visited here. Those summits will proceed on ahead. We have the strategic and economic dialogue, which occurs at the ministerial level, so there's no snub implied in this. It's more that it's a recognition of the political progress made in Myanmar and the attempt to continue to encourage that. But there are tensions, particularly, you know, Thailand's another place he's visiting, but it's not a direct stakeholder, but several other countries that are members of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, are engaged in territorial disputes with China, as is Japan.
Over some islands that are in the South China Sea?
South China Sea islands with the South China Sea states, the ASEAN states, and the Diaoyudao, or Diaoyu Islands, as China calls them, and the Senkaku, as Japan calls them, in the East China Sea. Mm.
Is there a resolution to that? Or, I mean,
no.
It seems like no, and this has been ongoing, but it seems as if the tensions have bubbled up recently.
Yeah,
it's
been a bad couple of years. I mean, within this last couple of years, it's been up and down some, but it's clearly been heightening tensions. It's part of a broader phenomenon, I think. China was on a real soft power roll, as one would call it, a real charm offensive to Southeast Asia. They established a free trade area with ASEAN. Relations with Japan were, you know, never good. The history question from World War II still looms large, but were relatively positive. There was a talk of joint development of oil fields in the disputed ocean zone. And then it started just going, you know, quite badly. Mostly, I think it's fair to say, a lot of it China's assertiveness. Some of it, the pushback from other states. We saw the dust up this summer with the Philippines over Hangyuan Island, the reef, Scarborough Reef, where you know, China asserted greater control, Philippines pushed back. And we see similar things going on in the East China Sea with the flotillas of fishing boats, Coast Guard, naval escorts. And those are, you know, unlikely to erupt in war, but the possibilities of incidents are certainly there, and it has created huge tensions between China and its neighbors. Now, some of that is, I think, Chinese missteps. Some of it is pushback by neighbors, but some of it is just part of the structural fact of when a country next to you becomes as powerful as China has and has invested as much in military modernization as China has, you got to worry about it. And what that's meant is a lot of hedging. It's been good for American security interests in the sense that many more states are seeing an interest in having a U.S. role in the region, but it comes against the backdrop of potentially escalating U.S.-China tensions.
But what is that assertiveness about? I mean, is it to gain some kind of control over the region? Are more subtle than that?
I think it's a mixture of things. One of the more specific items in Hu Jintao's final speech, the political report to this party Congress that's going on now, one of the more specific items was a reference to protecting maritime interests and to China becoming a maritime power. Mm-hmm. Now, some of this is what great powers do. You know, when you get to be the second most powerful country in the world, you tend to have more far-flung interests. You tend to think it is more an appropriate role for you to protect your interests in the coastal zones. Some of it's about resources, although not much. I think a lot of it is about territorial claims and status. Mm-hmm. I mean, these go back a long ways, and it's a question of China now being in more of a position to assert its will. Chinese, some sources in China would certainly tell you they are simply pushing back against aggressive moves by other states. You know, one can debate that. But some of it is also, I think, just a sense that in China, that China has now risen to great power status. And one of the debates that's going on now is how China will use its power. And one of the criticisms that Hu Jintao has faced is that he has been too soft, that he has been insufficiently assertive in having China claim its rightful place in the world. Now, there remains ambivalence on this, because Chinese will tell you they don't want a G2 with the U.S., or that that's not possible. And Europeans will joke that G20 is G2 plus zero, right? It's all about the U.S. and China. And there's a sense that when China does get assertive, the rest of the world pushes back, and that's fed this concern about an anti-Chinese plot led by the U.S.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have, looks like Kate from Morristown joining us on Radio Times. And Kate, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was in China in 1973 from April, May, and June for a business trip trying to sell offshore oil drilling equipment to the Chinese. I was taught subsequently at University of Pennsylvania. I audited under Karma Hinton, Chinese language. What I'd like to know is, in 1973, I think the population was 800 million, if I remember correctly. What are they doing in terms of policy toward population at this point?
Kate, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And what is the population of China at this point?
About 1.3 billion.
1.3.
Yeah. It's grown hugely, obviously. And boy, I'm envious of somebody who got to China that early.
Thanks, Kate, for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there has been an anti-natalist, a sort of population control policy in place for quite some time now. It started very near the beginning of the reform era and really stepped up in the early 80s. There's a lot of pressure now to change it, and partly because of its success. Fertility rates have come way, way down, and China is now facing the problem of an inverted age pyramid. The ratio of dependent people to working people is starting to go up. In fact, China right now is in a demographic sweet spot. There aren't that many old people who are past working ages, and we've got these very small generations from the single-child family era coming up. So you've now got this big bulge in the snake of people who are young enough not to retire but old enough to be working. So this is really kind of a golden age. But as that bulge in the snake moves through, you're going to get a lot more people over 60.
Their version of the baby boom, then.
Exactly, in effect. And so one has to worry about what happens going forward. So they're starting to see this, and it's producing a few consequences. One is they're trying to get into less labor-intensive, more knowledge-intensive things where populations don't matter as much. They are trying to save and invest in a way that will allow that the current group to retire relatively well. But there's actually a lot of pressure now to just simply scrap the policy or at least relax it considerably. And, it's never been fully enforced. But there's a belief that you can simply rely on economic pressures, particularly among the urban middle classes, not to have lots of kids, and that you actually need some more young people to pay the Social Security bills going forward. And so this is one of the things that's part of what's really becoming, on the eve of transition, an interesting set of policy proposals that are percolating up. So that's one of them, the single-child family policy reform. Another is public health care, public health provision reform, Social Security, that sort of thing. There are a bunch of these ideas kicking around. And the reports, at least from intellectual circles in Beijing, is that there's been a signaling of an interest in bold policy proposals, particularly social policy proposals, from the new leadership.
But does that tell us that their economy is slowing, or that boom that they enjoyed was just a moment in time?
It was a big, long moment in time.
It was.
But it's I think everybody expects a permanent lowering of growth rates. I mean, partly there was a lot of the advantages of backwardness, the catching up, the demographic sweet spot, all of that. Export-led growth, which clearly is fading because China's economy has gotten too big to rely on exports, and the markets in the developed world are clearly not booming the way they were pre-crisis, so they may come back up, but still there are limits. So there's a real sense that China has to rebalance. And one of the things that there's a good deal of leadership agreement on is the need to shift from export to domestic consumption, and probably away from what has been a heavily investment and indeed government investment in infrastructure-type-driven economy to one that relies more on consumers. But that's a tough transition to make.
Well, and it's more like the U.S., where about 70% of our economy is built on consumer demand.
Right, and there are long ways from that, but there's a sense they need to move in that direction. Also, partly you can get a certain amount of support from people just by the sheer pride in a growing economy, but at some level, consumers need to be made better off for economic legitimacy to continue as a foundation.
We talk about the divide between rich and poor in this country. I'm wondering how big that divide is in China.
Well, the standard measure of inequality, the Gini coefficient, the U.S. and China both look very bad by international standards in the sense of being highly unequal. But, of course, inequality is rather different in China. It's a less wealthy country. So per capita income has quintupled over the last generation or so, and the goal stated is another doubling by 2020. That's going to be tough to achieve, but there's a sense that you're trying to grow. But it's been highly unequal, and the attempts to ameliorate it have been really quite modest in their success.
So if someone is middle class in China, what does that mean that they have and do?
Well, there are a bunch of...
I'm sure it varies depending on where you live.
Right. There are a bunch of different attempts to define the middle class in China, but most people would define it as, you live in a city, you have an income that allows you, what by our standards would be very small, but a decent apartment, probably means a car, Toward the upper end of that, it may mean a driver. And you know, you get to send your kids to decent schools, you get some vacation time, you have the leisure to travel. I mean, in some ways, if you adjust for the kind of general differences in material trappings, particularly space, between, say, East Asia and the West, it's not that far off of what a middle-class existence would be in other East Asian countries. A little less well-off, but by Chinese standards, clearly, yeah, very well-off.
And when you're there, can you go wherever you want to go? Do you have minders, people? And I'm not sure how conversant you are in Chinese. And I'm sure you're pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, I do most of my work and speak to most of my friends there in Chinese. No, you don't get minders anymore, and you're generally pretty free to go around now. You know, if you're visible enough in one form or another, and I think most people who are reasonably well-known so-called China experts, we all have files and that sort of thing. But it's not terribly intrusive. I mean, people have varying levels of concern about what's getting onto their computers or off of their computers when they're sitting there and take various kinds of precautions against it. And obviously anybody who works for the State Department or the government has to be extremely wary. But it doesn't feel like a police state by any means. And people are generally quite willing to talk.
Oh, interesting. And is that a change, do you think?
Over the last many years, yes. And the climate hasn't changed much in the last, I don't know, decade or more. But certainly compared to the baselines, when I was there as a student in the late 80s and early 90s, my letters would arrive opened
and things of
that ilk. Right. But I mean, I think it's just a combination of growing liberalization, that there are just so many foreigners there, you couldn't possibly do it. Perhaps growing sophistication of monitoring in some contexts, but also just that there's just so much information flowing around. I mean, there are just, millions and millions and millions of tweets a day, hundreds of millions of people on the internet, things like that.
We're almost out of time here, but what advice would you give President Obama about China in 30 seconds or less? I'm sorry about that, Jack.
Fair question. That's a tough one. I mean, I think basically there's not room for any profound change in the relationship. It's a matter of just managing what is a complex but I think ultimately pretty stable and well-founded relationship. I think the biggest mistakes the U.S. has done is to have said and done things that have created impressions in some circles in China of one of two things: either inconsistency in American policy, in which case they believe they can wait out the criticism, and the other is just a sense that we don't really know what our agenda is, or maybe trying to contain them, which I think is something that needs to be beaten back regularly.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, letting me pick your brain about China. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. And that's Jacques Delisle. He's a professor of law, political science at the University of Pennsylvania, deputy director of the Center for the Study of Contemporary China, also director of the Asia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour, but stay with us. We'll be right back.